A daughter's search for her father's kidnappers, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In 1985, journalist Terry Anderson was abducted by militants in Beirut. Years later, his daughter, Sulome, went to find the men who did it.
As I became more familiar with the Middle East and with the situation in Lebanon, there were certain sort of dangling threads that I wanted to resolve.
Plus, Samsung pulls the plug on its flagship phone, which has shown a tendency to malfunction.
You don't want to be the person on the airplane with the exploding smartphone.
Yeah, too true. And Donald Trump says he doesn't like cheap Chinese steel, but others say he uses it in his projects.
Trump is a phony. In every facet of his life, he's never done anything for anybody but himself.
Those stories ahead today on The World. Glad you could be with us today, a day on the show when we'll be talking steel from China, hacks out of Russia, and crepes in London. But we're going to start off today in Colombia with the peace deal that wasn't, and this question: what happens when a government and rebel group agree to make peace after 50 years, but a majority of the population says no? That's a result of that referendum on peace with the FARC guerrilla group in Colombia a week ago. It could lead you to the conclusion that the peace deal failed. But does this really mark the end of hopes for peace in Colombia? The World's Jasmine Garst is reporting in Bogota.
It's a divided country. You know, when you say the majority of Colombians voted no, only 38% of Colombians turned out to vote on this referendum. It kind of was the Latin American Brexit. It had very low voter turnout. And of those voters, it was pretty much split down the middle. What it comes down to is people don't want leniency against the guerrilla members, that the people who voted no want more punitive measures against the guerrilla groups. And there's also people who don't want these Marxist guerrilla groups to have a presence in the government. Remember, Colombia's right next to Venezuela. They're watching their neighbors slowly collapse, and they don't want to become that. So those were two of the biggest fears.
So the narrative of this peace deal has been as a negotiation between the Colombian government and the guerrilla group, the FARC. But it's not just the FARC that the government has been negotiating with. There are other guerrilla groups as well. Just remind us who they are and what the differences are between the FARC and these other groups.
There's two major groups. FARC is the biggest. ELN, which stands for El Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the National Liberation Army, is the second biggest. And they have about 1,300 fighters. They're a lot smaller than FARC. They were born in the same year, 1964. FARC is mostly a peasant-based movement. ELN has Marxist intellectuals. They initially recruited young people and discontent intellectual middle classes. They also have like a religious component. They've been described as a mix between Jesus, Marx, and Che Guevara. But they do operate in very similar ways. They engage in kidnapping. They do acts of terrorism against the state, especially the oil industry. And they are considered a violent group, or were until recently.
And they were considered part of the peace deal. Is that right?
No, the government has been speaking to ELN for a while. This now takes it into an official public sphere. The last peace agreement, the one that just fell through, that was with FARC.
So what are the next steps for the peace deal, Jasmine? I mean, what is the state of it now? And can we expect in the future kind of a comprehensive peace deal that would address all of these guerrilla groups?
Both the government and the FARC have expressed a desire to continue peace talks and to start including the opposition. President Santos addressed the Colombian people last night. He talked about a sense of urgency because there's a ceasefire throughout October, but ceasefires are not indefinite. He also stressed, let's be realistic with the peace negotiation points, because, you know, you do have to convince FARC and ELN to come into the fold in the peace deal. So let's be realistic about our demands.
You also have to convince people to go to the polls, it sounds like. So as you've been speaking with Colombians, are they hopeful? Are they optimistic that things can be turned around and they'll be part of that? And the ceasefire maybe could turn into another peace agreement and another referendum that could pass.
Yesterday, I spoke to a priest, Father Rafael Narvaez. He runs an organization which is a school of forgiveness and reconciliation throughout the country. He has such a fascinating story. His brother was actually in the FARC. He comes from a very poor coffee-growing region. And he's in his 50s. And it was really shocking to ask him about peace and conflict in Colombia. And for a 50-something-year-old man to say, you know, I've never experienced peace. I don't know what that's like. And I would say that is the sentiment for an overwhelming majority of Colombians who do not remember what peace feels like. And they just want to know what that's like.
The World's Jasmine Garz in Bogota, Colombia. Thank you very much, Jasmine.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to Haiti. The country had been slowly emerging from the destruction after the 2010 earthquake. But Hurricane Matthew last week stopped that progress. The World's Amy Bracken is in Dom-Marie in the southwest of the country, which was the area hardest hit by Matthew. The damage and loss are devastating, and the fear now is the spread of waterborne cholera, which is already killing people there.
Everybody's talking about this. Aid workers, doctors, and just random people that I'm talking to on the street have been talking about this. They're terrified of cholera getting worse around here. They're terrified of people getting it, not being able to be taken to a clinic. Water is really a number one need right now. There's been a tremendous amount of water contamination, and there's just a lack of clean drinking water. So groups are coming in. They're trying to repair wells. They're trying to go to the source of where people are getting their water and chlorinating the water. They're also bringing in aquatabs. So this, fortunately, this does seem to be a pretty big priority for a number of aid groups.
So southwestern Haiti is one long peninsula, and I gather the only bridge across a key river has been destroyed. So how is aid actually getting across to the far western tip of the island? How did you get across?
Well, the river seemed like the biggest stumbling block at one point, and it really isn't anymore. We got across just by driving through because the water has gone down so much. So most 4x4 vehicles aren't going to have any problem getting through. I was told that the big problem would be that there would be sort of a pileup with all the aid convoys trying to make it through. And we were amazed that in this long journey over in this direction, we didn't actually see, maybe we saw one aid vehicle. So one issue is security, that there have been reports of people setting up roadblocks to try to get some of that aid along the way, and some reports of robberies. And so the police sent out an alert saying that everybody should really check in with them before bringing aid to the area and that they should get a police escort. And so that's really delayed the aid getting in, at least on land.
Right. So now that you're on the tip of the western part of the island in Dom-Marie, do you feel like some of that aid has gotten there?
Oh, very little of it. I think aid groups are working very hard, and I've seen them around. They are trying to assess what the needs are and how to deliver them as quickly as possible, but there's just such an enormous need. I mean, this is a huge swath of land, so it's going to take a very long time for the aid to reach people here, and they're going to be in need for a very long time. For example, here at the cacao cooperative, they're saying it might take 4 years for them to get their cacao farming up and running again.
So that's cacao beans being grown there in western Haiti. I mean, what about the people? I mean, how are they coping?
Well, the people are coping by trying to build back their roofs. First of all, that's a number one thing because, you know, people have had much of their goods destroyed by rain coming in through their gaping open roofs. So they're trying to put tin back on if they can get it. They're hoping to get plastic sheeting as well, which is coming in. And people are hoping to get water. They're trying to find clean sources of water for drinking. Looking for new ways of farming, too, how they're going to feed themselves in the future. So some of the cacao farmers are talking about maybe switching over to maize and beans for a period before they can get back into planting the cacao trees just so they can survive.
Wow, that suggests that the damage to the farms and other crops is bad.
Oh, it's absolutely devastating. It's unbelievable. Coconut trees, avocado trees, breadfruit, just so many different kinds of fruits and vegetables that people have relied on for generations. They're just decimated.
What about the emotional trauma? Because a lot of people died.
A lot of people did die, and the exact number is very unclear still because it's so hard to get out and get to the remote areas to find out. But what I'm hearing more from people is the fear of many more people dying because of the cholera outbreak.
Oh, wow. Amy, we reached you on a cell phone, but it was not easy. What about people on the island? Have they had any luck communicating with friends and family to make sure they're safe?
Well, when I was in Port-au-Prince a couple of days ago, I spoke to many people who asked me to check on family and friends while I was out here because they hadn't heard from them. Since then, just in the last day or so, there has been an improvement in communications. I mean, just the fact that I'm able to speak with you on cell phone in Damari now, that's a big step forward.
The world's Amy Bracken in Damari. Thanks very much, Amy.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Say no more to the Samsung Galaxy 7, or better yet, just say the phone has been extinguished. The Galaxy 7s have a tendency to catch fire. There are even online videos of the phones exploding. Samsung tried to fix the problem, but it didn't work, so now Samsung is ending all production of its popular smartphone. It is a bad day for the Korean brand, and it might get worse, because Samsung is also fighting Apple over their claim that Samsung essentially stole their smartphone design. BuzzFeed technology reporter Alex Kantrowitz is here to explain how this all affects Samsung's brand.
Well, I think you'd have to say it's not good. You don't want to be the person on the airplane with the exploding smartphone. So even if Samsung is ending production of the Galaxy Note 7, there might be some residual impacts for other products that Samsung is trying to sell and consumers are simply wary of.
How is the latest recall being treated by customers?
At this point, everybody's going to have to turn their Galaxy Note 7 in and get a refund. We know that replacements are also off the table. So any consumer who bought this device, and I think there were about 2.5 million sold when the first recall was announced. So anybody who has this device is going to bring it in and we'll see if they stick with Samsung or not.
I imagine airlines are probably breathing a sigh of relief.
You'd have to imagine that they are, but there are still going to be people who have these devices on them and are going to be bringing them on planes. I know I'm flying in the next few days and I'm pretty nervous. So airlines are going to have to continue to remain vigilant when they have people flying on their planes holding the Galaxy Note 7.
And you don't have a Galaxy Note 7. You're just nervous about other people who might be on the plane with one.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we've all seen the images of smoking Galaxy Note 7s on the floor of planes and planes that had to halt takeoff. Because they had one that was smoking. So personally, if any of my fellow travelers are considering bringing one of those phones on the plane, I urge you to not do it this time.
You think airlines will still keep making that announcement that if you have a Samsung, it's got to stay off for the whole flight? Will that keep going for a while?
Man, I would hope so, because just because Samsung announced a recall doesn't mean that everybody's going to turn the device in. So if airlines stop making the announcement that if you have a Galaxy Note 7, please don't, you know, keep it off. I think they're making a big mistake.
And at the same time, Alex, Samsung's also in court with Apple over essentially stealing. How does that play into everything?
That's right. When it rains, it pours. Samsung in 2011 was ordered to pay Apple $548 million, or about 445 million pounds, for ripping off Apple's grid icon design and their rectangular face with the rounded corners. Samsung is arguing, look, we maybe copied a bit of it, but we shouldn't be responsible for handing over all of our profits. That's like saying if a car maker copied a cup holder, they'd have to hand over all the profits for the car. So we'll see what the Supreme Court says.
Yeah, so bottom line, can Samsung rebound from all of this, or will Galaxy users be looking now at Apple or maybe Google for a new phone?
This is going to hurt Samsung, but it's not a fatal blow. They have a very strong components business. I don't think you're going to see them give up on the smartphone pursuit. And, you know, it's going to be a long-term thing, but certainly not good.
All right. We're going to leave it there, Alex. Alex Kantrowitz with BuzzFeed, their technology reporter. Really appreciate your time.
Definitely. Thanks for having me on.
This is The World. Taking on ISIS has not been the top priority of America's Gulf allies. That is one of the worrying conclusions from the latest documentary from our partners at Frontline. It's called Confronting ISIS, and it airs tonight on PBS stations. It is an epic telling of where we're at with ISIS. Correspondent Martin Smith traveled to five countries, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, and Turkey, to look at how ISIS has evolved and the role those longtime U.S. allies have in helping to fight ISIS. Take Saudi Arabia. Saudi officials disavow ISIS. The Saudi military has helped the U.S. target ISIS. And yet Saudi Arabia has supplied more ISIS recruits than any other Gulf state. At one point, Smith's documentary uses a split screen to give us a vivid comparison of ISIS justice versus Saudi justice.
We see a beheading and a whipping going on the left side of your screen that's going on in Saudi Arabia. And then we split the screen, and over on the right side, you see the same whipping and then a beheading going on the ISIS side of the screen. The sort of creed of ISIS springs from Wahhabism, the birthplace of Wahhabism, is Saudi Arabia. And there's a lot of sympathy for ISIS within Saudi Arabia. Now, there are many people in Saudi Arabia who, you know, by Saudi standards would be considered progressives, and they don't want that, but they don't control the entire country. And so you still have this sort of parallel between ISIS and much of Saudi society.
So meantime, the U.S. military search for Syrian moderates to fight ISIS has not been going very well. You have the Wall Street Journal's Adam Entis describing what happens to recruits who pass the initial vetting and want to cross the border into Syria, presumably with U.S. weapons. Here's Entis, followed by the voice of a Syrian rebel.
They show up at the crossing. They're literally made to sign a form that says that they are only going to fight ISIS. And you can imagine a lot of these guys turned around and walked away at that point.
The second rule in the training project is that we fight whoever fights us. The Assad regime is fighting us. Are we going to sit still and not fight Assad? We want Assad regime to be stopped.
So, Martin Smith, this seems to be one root of the problem. The U.S. is trying to convince the rebels to fight ISIS, but they're intent on toppling the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. That's their priority. Can they ever be convinced otherwise?
Well, that's a non-starter. Many of these people, these soldiers come from small villages that have been decimated, and they're supposed to leave their villages and go join an American effort to fight ISIS. So these soldiers are asked to sign this contract, and they balk. And it ends up being a disastrous effort on the United States' part. They spend $500 million, and they end up with four or five rebels.
That's it? At four the cost or five?
Yeah, $100 million, $125 million each, I guess you could say, these guys received in training. So it's a complete fiasco.
And even though President Obama approved the $500 million training program for these moderate rebels, he actually has been very, very skeptical about the whole program. Here's Peter Baker in your doc. He's with the New York Times.
President Obama, he never believed in it. He only did it because basically he had been browbeat into trying it. And then when it became a self-fulfilling prophecy that it didn't work, he said, I was right all along.
He is essentially wiping his hands of this program. And I think
that's an odd thing for a president to say.
It's unusual.
He's the guy in charge.
And it's pretty unusual to say, I never believed that this program I started would actually work.
And that I asked Congress for $500 million to fund.
$500 million to fund it. And then once it did fail, it became a political talking point to say, see, my critics were wrong all along.
And Martin Smith, later in your doc, Obama's deputy assistant Colin Call says the president isn't going to take military action unless you can, quote, tell him a story about how this ends. That seems fair, but it also strikes me as, on the president's part, pretty passive and, frankly, kind of lame duck to fork over $500 million and thinking, nah, this isn't going to work.
Well, there was a lot of skepticism within the administration, and there was a lot of division at the highest levels inside the cabinet over what kind of support we should give to rebels either fighting Assad or fighting ISIS. They have another force of Kurds, and they've put together this force now called the Syrian Democratic Force. It's about 80% Kurds. It's got Kurdish leadership, and they've got about 20% of Syrian Arabs now fighting. This is sort of out of the rubble of the failed program that you're talking about. And they're fighting ISIS with some success. The problem there is that the Turks have shelled them. And it's just very hard to move in any direction in the Middle East without finding yourself up against somebody you thought was your ally.
So a couple of years ago, there was a big debate at the White House over the precise wording of the mission against ISIS, and they settled on to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. So bottom line, where is the world at in that mission, and more importantly, where are we at in destroying the ideology that led to ISIS or any number of other groups like them?
Well, they've certainly degraded the organization and its ability to project force and to expand its territory. Where we're not making as much progress as we would like would be in the ideology, as you say. They're still a potent force. And until you can settle the sectarian issues, until Sunnis feel that they are not disenfranchised, you're going to have people, wealthy sheikhs with deep pockets, willing to support a group that sort of holds a front line, however brutal and nasty the group might be. And then their ability to attract people abroad and to send somebody out to Paris or to inspire somebody in San Bernardino, that's going to continue.
Is the next administration likely to act on options that this White House isn't? How likely is it that Hillary Clinton would make good on her pledge if she's elected to arm the Kurds and put the U.S.-Turkish relationship into jeopardy.
Well, we are arming the Kurds to some degree. Perhaps she will step it up. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. She talked in the debate the other night about a no-fly zone. I think that's a difficult ask because, again, you've got to come up against the air defenses of Bashar al-Assad, the leader of Syria, and you've got to come up against the Russian Air Force. Mr. Trump didn't have the wherewithal to ask her how she was going to do that. It would have been interesting for that part of the conversation to go a little longer.
Frontline's Martin Smith, his documentary Confronting ISIS airs tonight on PBS stations. Marty, thank you very much.
Marco, thank you.
Tonight's episode of Frontline also reminds us of the Westerners ISIS has taken hostage. And later on the show, a look back at another story of one well-known hostage. Terry Anderson was working for the Associated Press in Beirut in 1985. He was kidnapped by Hezbollah militants and held for years. Suleme Anderson is his daughter. She's also a journalist. And recently, she set out to meet and confront one of her father's abductors.
You know, he made these choices and they were, you know, horrible, wrong, evil in many ways choices. But when I met him and when we finally started, you know, going into what happened, it was very clear to me that he was torn between this need to justify what he did and tell himself that it was for the good of his country and his people, and the very real human shame he was feeling because he knew that what he did was wrong. It was very clear to me.
My conversation with Suleme Anderson, that's coming up in about 20 minutes. You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. French producers are raising their prices because Brexit.
Is the fear of the consequences of the Brexit. Is the unknown that scare people.
So a London crêperie is using local products instead of French ones. But will customers tolerate swapping Brie for Stilton? The answer to that, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It is pretty disturbing. Last week, the Obama administration finally said out loud what others have been saying for a long time, that Russian officials authorized the hack into the Democratic National Committee's email account, and the intent was to influence the U.S. election. Russia's response was denial. Now, it wouldn't be the first time, though, Russia was suspected of a big hack. There's evidence emerging that it may have been behind the takedown of a French TV network in 2015. My colleague, the BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera, has been looking into the strange case of TV5 Monde. What do we know about what happened to TV5 Monde, Gordon?
Well, this was a dramatic night about a year and a half ago at TV5 Monde when they had just on April the 8th launched a new TV channel. When the director general, Yves Bigot, went off for dinner that evening. And as he told me, something rather dramatic then happened.
Just as we were being served our appetizers, suddenly a fleet of messages came on my mobile phone. The channels are down. You know, we don't know what to do. We don't know what happened. They were down for 9 hours. Of dark screen, which is the worst thing that can happen to you in television, of course.
So the screens were down, all 12 networks went dark, and as they started examining those computer systems that ran the TV channels, they realized that something pretty serious was going on, and they'd been attacked by a computer virus which was working its way through the systems, corrupting the technology used to output the TV channels.
So how much damage was actually done, and when were they able to correct the problems on all these networks?
Well, what's remarkable about this is that Yves Bigot says it came very close to actually destroying the whole network. And it was only good fortune that because they'd launched the new channel that day, that they had engineers on site who were then able to try and deal with the problem.
Wow.
So it was a close call for that French TV channel from being totally wiped out.
So how do we know for sure that Russian hackers were involved in this?
Well, this is what's so curious about this incident because Yves Bigot says he's been told by the French investigators that it was a group of Russian hackers who'd carried out the attack on his TV network.
And what about the connection between those hackers and the Kremlin? Is there any hard evidence there?
Well, that's what's so interesting, is that this is a group of Russian hackers known as APT-28, also known as Fancy Bear by some security analysts, who've also been linked to a series of other attacks. So they have been linked to the intrusions in the Democratic National Committee, also to the leak of data about athletes from the anti-doping agency after the Olympic Games. And so this is a very active group of Russian hackers. Now, Yves Bigot and the French investigators say they cannot definitively prove who gave the order to those Russian hackers. So they are not quite pointing the finger at the Kremlin here, but they are saying that it was certainly hackers from Russia.
You mentioned the anti-doping agency, the hack on them. I mean, they've been going after Russian athletes. I get the hack into the DNC. But why would Teve Sankmon be a target for a concentrated attack like this?
Now, that's what's so interesting about this case, because even if you speak to Teve Sankmon, they don't quite understand it. And I've spoken to a lot of intelligence officials here in London as well about why they think it happened. And they struggled with it, actually. There were kind of long debates within, I think, the US, the UK, French intelligence community about why this happened. And the resultant view I know in London was that actually this was Russia testing its cyber weapons to see if these kind of techniques could be used and if they'd work in practice.
So based on what you research, what you investigated, Gordon, can we expect more of these?
Teve Sankmon happened a while ago, although we've only really understood how sophisticated it was now and who was behind it. But then if you look in the last few months, we've had more and more of these hacks. And we've had, in some cases, we've had things like a power station turned off in Ukraine. In other cases, we've had information used as a weapon. For instance, the release of those Democratic Party emails and the anti-doping material. So what you're seeing, I think, is a more aggressive posture by Russia in cyberspace. It is pushing the boundaries. It is seeing what it can do as relations with Western countries deteriorate. The question I think that policymakers will be looking at is what kind of action is required to get Russia to potentially back off if indeed, as it looks like, it is centrally directed from Moscow.
The BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera, thanks very much for walking us through this, Gordon.
Thank you.
Let's take a moment now to pick up a thread from Sunday's presidential debate. You may recall an exchange between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump about steel.
We have to bring back our workers. You take a look at what's happening to steel and the cost of steel and China dumping vast amounts of steel all over the United States, which essentially is killing our steel workers and our steel companies.
To which Clinton responded,
China is illegally dumping steel in the United States and Donald Trump is buying it to build his buildings, putting steel workers and American steel plants out of business.
It is a little confusing, so we asked the world's Jason Margolis to look into the claims.
First, let's just define the problem with steel today. Overcapacity. Scott Paul is president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, which was started in part by the United Steelworkers. He explains the basics.
Overcapacity is actually pretty simple. It's when a country, or in aggregate the world, is producing more of something than it needs. So the consumer demand is lower than the production.
Simply put, right now, the world is awash in too much steel. Nearly half of the excess is coming from China. Scott Paul argues that China operates by a different set of guidelines.
Its steel industry is not profit motivated. It's generally controlled by the government in Beijing. It's used as an employment policy as well as manufacturing.
The U.S. and Europe can't compete with Chinese prices, often below the cost of production. China has been violating existing international trade laws to do that. The result, around 15,000 American steel and iron workers have lost their jobs over the past year, and thousands more are facing potential layoffs. So that's the situation. Now, let's briefly revisit Sunday night's debate. Donald Trump brought up steel first.
China dumping vast amounts of steel all over the United States,
and Donald Trump is buying it to build his buildings.
Here's what Clinton is talking about. Last week, Newsweek reported that Donald Trump purchased steel and aluminum from China for two of his high-profile construction projects in Las Vegas and Chicago. The buildings opened in 2008 and 2009. According to Newsweek's investigation, Trump purchased Chinese metals using shell companies in the British Virgin Islands. That's not a crime, but it infuriates Leo Gerard, president of the United Steelworkers Union. He spoke with me today from a car phone.
Trump is a phony, and quote me on that. In every facet of his life, he's never done anything for anybody but himself.
Gerard says Trump could have bought American steel, but he chose cheaper steel from China, then tried to hide it.
It goes to prove consistent with his behavior. We see what he did in his clothing line. We see what he did in his furnishing line. And we're seeing what he's doing with manufacturing goods.
Still, Trump doubled down on his promises, speaking yesterday in western Pennsylvania.
Let me tell you, that's going to be turned around on day one if I win. On day one, your jobs are coming back to Pennsylvania, and they're coming back to this area. And that means we're going to take care of our steel workers, and we're going to take care of our miners. Believe me, we're going to take care of
them. Economists seem to agree, though, you can't turn back the clock. In the 1970s, 250,000 people worked in the steel industry in Pennsylvania. Today, that figure is closer to 40,000. Still, Trump's message of hope, even without any specifics how he'd restore jobs, resonates in steel country. I was in western Pennsylvania a few weeks ago and met a lot of people like Steve Toprani and Benjamin Fisher who support Trump.
He's really one of the first national candidates to speak at this local level about the want for industry. So just the fact that he's engaged in this dialogue is something that many voters haven't seen in a generation.
Just like any other politician, and I got to put him into the politician mix. I don't think they can do everything they say they can do. So it's kind of like, why not give the guy a shot for 4 years? If it doesn't work out, we can always go back to all the politicians before.
Leo Gerard with the United Steelworkers Union says bringing back steel jobs requires smart policies on investment and trade. He says Hillary Clinton has offered solid solutions, working within the law to prosecute China for violating existing trade rules. As for Trump, Gerard said he's seen steel communities hollowed out, and he can't stomach the idea that people are putting hope in Trump's promises.
It makes me a combination of angry, sad, and disappointed. So I think that we've got time to continue to educate people, and I don't want to see them having a broken heart another time.
For the World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Brexit is coming, but it hasn't happened yet. British Prime Minister Theresa May says her country will start the process of quitting the European Union in early 2017. And it could take a couple of years, but British businesses say they're already feeling it. And some are responding to the uncertainty by going local in ways they never expected to. Here's Adeline Sia from London.
South Kensington is one of the most Euro-chic and Francophile neighborhoods of London. There are busy cafes, a French bookstore, a designer pastry shop, and an elegant eatery that serves waffles and crepes. That's the Kensington Creperie. Michele Zavani, who's Italian, is the general manager here.
We are a French creperie, so we work with a lot of French suppliers, especially from cheese, flour, cider.
Zavani says shortly after the Brexit vote last June, he had to wait more than 2 weeks for a delivery of cider from Brittany. It had never happened before and was a huge handicap for the business. So Zavani says his boss got a funny feeling about it and started looking for substitutes closer to home.
Because of the fear of the Brexit, because of the fear that the French producer will take advantage to raise the price of the product, my boss start to relocate the supplier in UK to try to avoid even the risk to have to face an enormous rise of price in product.
And sure enough, right after the vote, the creperie's buckwheat flour supplier in France began to charge more.
And he start to rise the price, let's say 2-3%. And when we ask why, they say, yeah, we have to face the Brexit result. I say, but in which way? We haven't seen any effect yet. But we work ahead. This is the answer. We work ahead. It's crazy. I know it's crazy.
Colin Stenbridge thinks that's nonsense too at this stage. He is the head of the London Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
We've had a number of stories of people saying, suppliers are putting their prices up, but there's absolutely no reason to put the prices up apart from a supplier seeing an opportunity to make more money.
But even without price gouging, international goods are already more costly because the British pound is at a 31-year low, in part because of Brexit. Now, over 3 months past the shock of the Leave vote, Stanbridge says the London business community is looking to move on with a stiff upper lip.
If you were a Brexiteer, if you're someone who wanted to leave, you say, now I can be free of all the bureaucracy from Brussels. If you're a person who voted to remain, you're going to say, well, it wasn't the vote I wanted, it wasn't the result I wanted, but I'm going to make the best of it.
Still, Stanbridge fears the city could lose its cosmopolitan flavour if international workers and products are pushed out.
I would argue that the restaurants, cuisine in London outstrips most European cities now. And the reason for that is because we've attracted so many different nationalities to come and set up restaurants and serve their communities. And that vibrancy, not to mention great food, is important to the nature of a city and why I love living in London and why I'm slightly nervous about what London might become in a post-Brexit situation.
At the Kensington Creperie, Zavani says many of his new European co-workers are considering leaving the UK. He's not too worried about his own ability to live and work in England long term, but he's concerned about his diminished purchasing power and whether he still have access to his pension plan after Brexit goes into effect. For now, though, he's trying to handle the Creperie's new business model as best he can. And that means getting their once French items locally. Zavani says, in a sense, it's great because deliveries come faster and goods are fresher.
Like, for example, we got an eggman, live 30 kilometers outside London. We got a milkman, milk the cow 30 kilometers from London. The cider comes just from outside London. And the flour for Hertfordshire is actually organic, it's very good flour. And I think many restaurants and business will try to avoid as much as possible the supplier in Europe.
Zavani recognizes there's no urgent need to take such measures, but that shell-shocked business owners are erring on the side of caution.
But it's not the Brexit itself, it's the fear of the consequences of the Brexit. It's the unknown that scare people. So you try to adapt yourself, and this is the best way to adapt our business, go local. But for sure it's not good for a French producer.
It's too early to tell who will be helped or hurt most by Brexit, but some customers at the Kensington Creperie are already feeling its side effects. Zavani says among the regulars who are now served English Stilton cheese instead of French Roquefort cheese, a few have already complained that the crepes no longer taste French. For The World, Adeline Cyr, London.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. When AP Beirut bureau chief Terry Anderson was kidnapped in 1985, his wife was pregnant. Their daughter Suleyme was born just months after Anderson was seized by Shiite radicals. Although Suleyme was just a child during her father's years in captivity, her mother never hid from her what had happened.
I always had a picture of him under my pillow that I would kiss every night before I went to bed.
Suleyme Anderson says she thought of her father as bigger than life, almost a superhero, until one night when she was six and her mother woke her up from a deep sleep and they set out on a journey.
We got on an army plane and flew to Damascus, Syria, where I immediately fell asleep because I was very tired on a couch in the American embassy. And my father woke me up and I remember thinking he didn't look anything like what I thought he would look like. Mm. And he said, you know, hi, I'm your father. And then he took my hand and all three of us, my mother, my father, and I, walked out of the embassy into this media circus. There was just, you know, people everywhere, hundreds and hundreds of people and noise and lights and cameras. And I just remember, you know, feeling his hand shake. And he had this big smile on his face and all the news footage, he's beaming. But I remember feeling him sort of recoil from the noise and the lights.
I mean, it's hard to imagine how any family can just pick up as if nothing happened and just carry on after that. I know things quickly unraveled for your family after your father came back to live with you. You argued a lot. It was very tense. Why do you think that was?
My dad was very insistent that he was fine and unaffected by what happened. And on the surface, he seemed fine. I remember everybody saying, your father looks so much better than we thought he'd look. But I think the reality was he wasn't fine at all. And his way of coping with what happened to him was to build a wall around himself while he was in captivity, and it was very hard for him to come out from behind that wall and, you know, build a relationship with me.
So decades later, in your 20s, you set out to find the men who kidnapped your father. I know your father had his own explanation for who had held him. Why were you not willing to accept his version of events?
I accepted the version of events that I was told. It was just, as I became more familiar with the Middle East and with the situation in Lebanon, there were certain sort of dangling threads that I wanted to resolve.
You were reporting another story and then stumbled across a local Hezbollah member. You identify him only as the Masul or the official. He kind of needs to confess to you that he was among your father's captors, right?
Well, I had no idea who he was for a long time. He found out who my father was, you know, after we had spent some time together.
The Masul says, if Terry Anderson comes to me today, to my house, I will embrace him and say I'm sorry, but I do not regret what I did. That sounds kind of contradictory to me. What was he trying to say?
Again, not to excuse anything that he's done, but he was very young when it happened. He was about 17 years old, and his country was being devastated by war. And, you know, he made these choices, and they were, you know, horrible, wrong, evil in many ways choices. But when I met him and when we finally started going into what happened, it was very clear to me that he was torn between this need to justify what he did and tell himself that it was for the good of his country and his people, and the very real human shame he was feeling because he knew that what he did was wrong.
So were you able to kind of come to some understanding with this man, and was that what he was trying to get to with you?
For a long time, I couldn't figure it out. I was saying, why is this man speaking to me about this? You know, he has no reason to, and every reason not to. There's still money for turning him or anyone else involved in these acts in to the FBI. And, you know, by the end, I figured out that what he really wanted from me was forgiveness. He wanted me to forgive him. And, you know, it was not easy for me to get to the place where I felt like I could. But when I did, it wasn't for his sake, but it was for my sake. And it was just a very cleansing experience to let go of that anger.
Did your father ever want to go back and meet this man, the Masul?
No, I asked him, you know, what would you say to him? Do you want me to say anything to him? And Dad said, I have nothing to say to him. I just want to move on, essentially.
How did he feel about your meeting, the Masul?
You know, it was difficult for him, I think. He was worried about me, obviously, because this man had done terrible things and, you know, may or may not be capable of doing them again. But, you know, the thing is, my father is a reporter. He was a very good reporter. And I think mostly he was just impressed that I got him to talk to me. He was very proud of that.
Suleyma, you're very open in your book about your substance abuse, your struggle with your mental health. Do you trace these problems to the kidnapping of your dad and its aftermath?
I mean, to a certain extent, absolutely. I was diagnosed with a personality disorder in my early 20s, and there is a genetic component to that, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, when you look at the way my psyche was developed and was formed, there's no doubt that my experience, my family's experience, played a huge role in forming my self-image, which, you know, was very negative for a long time.
So fast forward to the present. We've seen an alarming number of journalists abducted, some released, some murdered. Do you feel it's the same level of danger today as when Terry Anderson was held hostage, or has something changed?
Well, yeah. I mean, the way that in which Westerners are kidnapped now in Syria is, you know, completely different. The motivations are different. When my father was taken, it was because my father was valuable. His life was valuable to them. He was essentially human currency. They wanted to trade him for, you know, certain political gains or concessions. You know, he was valuable to them alive. Whereas now, you know, when ISIS kidnaps an American, it's because their death is more valuable to them than their life.
So you're married now. You've written this book, answered some questions for yourself. Do you feel you've turned the page on this ordeal?
I believe so. You know, it's very cliche to talk about how a book like this is cathartic, but it has brought my father and I much closer together. It's helped me understand what happened to him and, you know, process my own grief and loss and damage that this event had on my life. And the funny thing about my dad is, you know, as I said, he was so convinced for so long that there was nothing wrong with him. And until I started writing this book, I think he truly believed that. But when he understood what I was writing about and saw that my experience had been quite different, I think he started admitting to himself that, you know, he had suffered much more psychological damage than he thought. And now I just see him having all these emotions. It's like he's accessed part of himself that was unavailable to him previously.
Sulamae Anderson is the author of The Hostage's Daughter, A Story of Family Madness in the Middle East. It's about her search to find the kidnappers of her father, the former AP Mideast Bureau Chief, Terry Anderson. Thanks very much, Sulamae. Great to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
And that is The World for this Tuesday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.